Usually when we talk about getting in shape for a sport, there's this expectation of a really simple metric, right?
Right, yeah, like a very straightforward, comforting input-output model.
Exactly. It's almost like basic engineering. If you want to run a marathon, what do? You just run longer distances.
Yeah, and if you want to lift heavy, you just add more plates to the bar. The human brain really, really loves that binary equation.
We do. We love things to be clean and linear. But then you step out of the ice for a game of hockey.
And that equation just shatters, completely shatters.
Right, because when you look at the biological reality of this sport, we're basically dealing with a physiological landscape that is a massive walking contradiction.
It really is. I mean, it is the absolute definition of metabolic muddy waters.
Oh, for sure.
When you think about it, you're asking the human body to sprint like an Olympic track athlete, wrestle in the corners like a judo athlete, and then somehow recover your heart rate like a Tour de France cyclist.
All while balancing on two razor-thin blades of steel on frictionless ice.
Oh, and other people are actively trying to hit you.
Right, exactly. Which is exactly why we're here today.
Yes, welcome to this deep dive. If you're listening to this right now, you're probably someone who plays the game. Maybe you coach, or maybe you're just, insanely curious about the limits of human performance.
And our mission today is completely different from just a standard fitness chat.
Yeah, we are not just going to give you a list of five exercises to do at the gym. We are going to build a complete integrated mental model of how the human body reacts to, survives, and recovers from the brutal demands of ice hockey.
The goal here is genuine mastery. By the end of this conversation, you're going to understand the underlying physiology so intimately that you can train smarter and actually avoid those catastrophic injuries and instantly identify the hidden red flags of a concussion, right? Plus, we're going to teach you how to fundamentally dominate the third period of a game when everyone else is falling apart.
Yeah, you'll be able to explain exactly why certain training methods work and why some incredibly popular fitness myths you see on the internet are just dead wrong.
To do this, we're pulling from this massive, highly detailed manual that we've been reviewing. It's titled Conditioning and Recovery Learning to Play the Game.
This thing is just an absolute gold mine.
It really is. It's
Yeah.
packed with recent sports science literature, actual NHL player tracking data, and deeply rigorous physiological research.
We're talking studies ranging from 2024 to 2026. They literally pull back the curtain on everything from the biochemistry of your individual muscle fibers to the actual bone-level biomechanics of your groin and hips.
What's so fascinating here is that it acts as this masterclass in translating biological realities into tactical advantages.
Right. It's not just science for the sake of science. It's science applied directly to winning a hockey game.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can talk about how to train, we have to talk about what we're actually training for.
We have to define the biological reality of a shift.
Right, and I want to throw a scenario out to you, the listener, right now. Think about the people at your local gym or in your rec league. Have you ever wondered why a marathon runner, someone with undeniably elite cardiovascular fitness, can step onto the ice and be completely gassed after just two shifts?
Leaning heavily on their stick, yeah.
Exactly. Yet on the flip side, you have a massive weightlifter who can outsquat everyone in the building, looks like a Greek god, but they completely fade into a ghost by the third period.
It's the classic hockey paradox. And keep those two athletes in your mind because we are about to solve that mystery today.
So to solve it, we have to zoom way down to the microscopic reality of cellular energy. We have to look at the exact shape and biological cost of a single hockey shift.
So let's look at the data. What actually is a shift?
Well, according to a really comprehensive 2024 review by V. Larson and Moore, the typical shift lasts roughly 30 to 80 seconds.
And that frantic burst is followed by a much longer period of largely passive recovery sitting on the bench, which is usually around 2 to 5 minutes.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture using NHL regular season tracking data from the 2024 to 2025 season, the numbers are incredibly precise.
Yeah, skaters who played at least half a season averaged about 21 shifts per game.
Which breaks down to roughly 19.4 shifts for forwards and an even 24 shifts for defensemen. But the mean shift length across the entire league was right at 47.8 seconds.
Think about that math for a second. When you add all that up, a player is only looking at about 15 to 25 minutes of total on-ice time for an entire game.
But it's spread across roughly 20 violent bursts of extreme effort. And here's where it gets really interesting, how that work is distributed based on your position completely shatters a common myth.
Oh, absolutely. There's this brilliant tracking study by Lignell and colleagues that looked at NHL players. A lot of people just assume forwards do all the running.
Right, but the data says otherwise. Defensemen actually covered 29% more total skating distance than forwards, and they were on the ice 47% longer overall.
However, the forwards performed 54% more high-intensity, high-speed skating per minute than the defensemen.
So if I'm visualizing this, defensemen are covering more ground overall. It's like a sustained, heavy, slow burn.
While forwards are executing way more violent high-speed bursts.
But regardless of whether you play forward or defense, the fundamental biological challenge to the human body is exactly the same.
And to understand that challenge, we need to talk about how the body produces the energy to move.
We're talking about the fundamental currency of life here, ATP, or adenosine triphosphate.
ATP is quite literally the chemical currency of energy in the human body. Your muscles cannot contract, your heart cannot beat without it.
But here's the biological catch. You only store a microscopic amount of ATP in the muscle tissue itself, like just enough for a second or two of movement.
Right. To keep moving, your body has to constantly manufacture more ATP on the fly. And it has three different factories or energy systems to do that.
I love the mental model the manual uses for this. Let's use an analogy to make this crystal clear. I want you to think of your body on the ice as a high-performance hybrid sports car.
That's a perfect analogy.
So the first energy system is called the phosphocreatine system, or PCR. This is your electric battery.
And this electric battery is instantaneous. It provides a massive, immediate surge of ready-made chemical energy. But the tank is incredibly small.
It's exactly what powers your first three or four explosive strides off the bench, right?
Exactly. Or the violent torque of a heavy slap shot, or a vicious five-second battle pinned against the glass. But it completely runs empty in about 10 to 15 seconds.
So once that electric battery is drained after 15 seconds, you're still on the ice. The car needs to keep moving, so it kicks into the second system.
The glycolytic system. This is your nitrous boost.
It's fast, it's powerful, and it breaks down carbohydrates rapidly without needing to wait for oxygen to arrive from your lungs.
Right. Glycolysis provides the bulk of the intense energy for hard efforts, lasting from about 10 seconds up to maybe 2 minutes.
But the nitrous boost has a severe biological cost. It burns dirty.
Very dirty. The process of rapidly breaking down those carbs without oxygen produces metabolic byproducts, and these byproducts accumulate in the muscle tissue.
And they are exactly what causes that intense, heavy burning sensation in your quads late in a long shift, right? Your body just becomes highly acidic.
Exactly. You simply cannot rely on the nitrous system forever. It will force you to starve.
Which brings us to the third system, the aerobic or oxidative system.
If the PCR is the electric battery and glycolysis is the dirty nitrous boost, the aerobic system is the gas engine and the alternator.
It burns carbohydrates and fats, but it uses oxygen to do it. It's much slower to ramp up, but it's effectively unlimited in duration as long as you have fuel.
And here is the absolute most critical part of this entire concept. The aerobic system, the alternator, is what physically recharges the electric battery while you are sitting on the bench recovering.
This is so important. Recharging that instant energy electric battery so you can explode off the bench again, it's an entirely oxygen-dependent process.
If your aerobic engine, your alternator, is weak, your battery physically cannot fully recharge in the 2 minutes you sit on the bench between shifts.
Which leads us to the ultimate aha moment of the deep dive. There's a 2026 study by Gabriels and colleagues where they measured the exact energy contributions during repeated high-intensity efforts mimicking hockey.
And the total energy split was 63.1% aerobic, 29.8% phosphagen, the battery, and only 7.4% glycolytic, the nitrous.
Wait, that feels deeply counterintuitive to anyone who has ever played a shift and felt their lungs burning. 63% aerobic.
We have to read that data carefully. That 63% split is measured across the whole protocol, which importantly includes the recovery periods on the bench.
Oh, I see. So during the first 15 seconds of a live shift, the anaerobic systems, the electric battery, and the nitrous are doing almost all the heavy lifting.
Yes, but the aerobic share of the total energy climbs higher and higher the more shifts you string together, because the aerobic system is working overtime, desperately trying to rebuild the battery in between those bursts.
So if I'm summarizing this into a golden rule for the listener, hockey is anaerobic within a shift, but it is deeply aerobic across a whole game.
Precisely. And this framework perfectly answers your earlier scenario about our two athletes.
Right. Why does the elite marathon runner die after two shifts on the ice?
Because the marathon runner has a world-class alternator, but they have absolutely no nitrous boost and a tiny little electric battery. Their anaerobic system is vastly undertrained.
They can produce low-level energy steadily for hours, but they cannot produce a massive amount of energy instantly to win a puck battle.
Furthermore, they can't tolerate the acidic byproducts of the glycolytic system when they are forced into it.
Plus, to add insult to injury, they're moving in a totally unfamiliar movement pattern. The wide lateral push of skating loads the hips and groin in a way forward running simply doesn't.
Exactly. And what about the massive weightlifter, the sprinter who looks unstoppable for 5 minutes but dies in the third period?
They're the exact opposite. They have a massive electric battery and tons of nitrous. Their first shift of the game is terrifyingly fast and powerful.
But their alternator is tiny because their aerobic system is weak. Their body cannot use oxygen efficiently to rebuild their phosphor creatine battery while they sit on the bench.
So they come back for shift number two, but their battery is only 80% full. Shift three, it's 60%.
By the time the third period rolls around, they are starting every shift with a 15% battery. They are quite literally skating in mud because they don't have the biological fuel to contract their muscles quickly.
If we synthesize this, it really challenges how people usually train.
Yeah.
If you are listening to this and your off-season prep is just running 3 miles a day at a steady pace, you're missing half the equation.
Or conversely, if you just go to the gym and do heavy sets of five on the squat rack with 5 minutes of rest, you're also missing half the equation.
Anaerobic power determines how good your best shift is. But aerobic fitness determines how similar your 20th shift is to your first.
Yeah.
You absolutely need both.
That is such a crucial takeaway. But, you know, fatigue across a game isn't just about oxygen and batteries. It is also fundamentally a fuel tank problem, right?
Absolutely. The Vi Larson review notes that hockey's highly intermittent, high-intensity pattern heavily favors muscle glycogen as its primary fuel source.
Glycogen being the stored carbohydrates physically sitting inside the muscle tissue.
Correct. And despite the actual playing time only being 15 to 25 minutes total, this intense on and off pattern leads to severe depletion of glycogen in both your fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers.
When an individual muscle fiber runs empty of glycogen, it cannot contract forcefully, no matter how much oxygen you breathe in.
This is exactly why player tracking data universally shows that the ability to perform high-intensity skating is severely compromised in the final stages of a game. The physical fuel tanks in the legs are empty.
Okay, so we've mapped out the biological reality. We know how the machine works. Now, how do we actually build a better machine?
Right. How do we translate this biology into an actual functional training program?
The manual breaks this down conceptually into five major areas of focus, or buckets.
Let's start with the foundation. Bucket one, the aerobic base. We just talked about how crucial this is as the recovery engine.
Yes. Building this broad aerobic base buys you three massive advantages. Faster rebuilding of that phosphor creatine battery between shifts, faster clearance of those acidic glycolytic byproducts that make your legs burn, and a lower overall heart rate at any given workload, saving you energy.
But I want to get granular here. What does this actually look like in practice? Because I feel like a lot of amateurs completely mess this up.
No, it's a very common mistake. They either go too easy or they accidentally turn it into a high-intensity workout.
Right.
True aerobic-based training looks like genuinely easy, conversational-paced, continuous work. We are talking about cycling, rowing, light jogging, or brisk uphill walking for a continuous 30 to 60 minutes.
The defining feature, and this is where people fail, is that it should feel almost too easy.
Exactly. If you can't hold a conversation while doing it, you are going too hard and tapping into your glycolytic system.
Most amateur athletes train their easy recovery sessions way too hard and their hard sprint sessions too easy. The result is they end up in this mushy middle ground where they don't get the maximum physiological adaptation from either system.
And the manual is very clear on this next point. Do this off the ice. Ice time is way too expensive and frankly too chaotic to spend it just skating laps at a 50% heart rate.
Makes total sense. Okay, moving on to the second bucket. Anaerobic capacity and repeat sprint ability. This is training for the violence of the shift itself.
Right. If the aerobic base is the alternator, this is upgrading the nitrous system and the battery. This training buys you a bigger, more repeatable hard effort.
And the biological ability to tolerate that burning discomfort of a long shift without slowing down.
The prescription here is simple but brutal. You literally copy the demands of the game. You want maximum hard efforts of roughly 30 to 45 seconds, followed by 2 to 4 minutes of recovery repeated 6 to 12 times.
So you could do that on an assault bike, a rowing machine, or running up a steep hill. But the work-to-rest ratio is the entire point, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
If someone does 30 seconds of sprinting and only takes 30 seconds of rest because they want to, you know, sweat more, they're actually ruining the workout.
Exactly. If you shorten the rest to 30 seconds, you are certainly building a type of fitness and you will feel exhausted, but you are no longer training the specific energy pathways that hockey demands.
You aren't giving the battery time to recharge, so you end up just slogging through the later sprints at low power.
You have to honor the rest periods to maintain the high power output required for hockey.
That brings us to the third bucket, lower body strength and power. This is for your stride length, your explosiveness, and winning those board battles.
Now, wait, I want to push back on this a little bit, actually.
Okay, for it.
In hockey culture, there is this massive obsession with heavy barbell back squats. The guy who squats 500 pounds is automatically assumed to be the fastest skater. Does huge, raw lower body strength actually transfer directly to faster skating speed on the ice?
That is a phenomenal question, and it's one sports scientists have spent a lot of time on. And honestly, the evidence says that gym strength transfers partially rather than hugely.
Really? Just partially?
Yeah. There is a fascinating 2024 study by Kiner and colleagues published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research that looked exactly at this.
What did they find?
They found that maximum strength tests and off-ice jump tests explained anywhere from just 1% to 35% of the variance in on-ice linear sprint performance.
Wow.
And about 22% to 30% of the variance in in-game peak skating speed.
1 to 35% is a massive, highly variable range. That means for some players, their gym strength barely mattered at all for their skating speed.
Exactly. And there was another study in 2024 by Roxniok that looked at elite under 16 players. They found that in the truly elite skaters, their sprint speed was actually less related to their off-ice jumping ability than it was in sub-elite players.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, the meaning is clear. As you get better and more elite at skating, your technique becomes the limiting factor, not your raw muscular strength.
Strength is a real contributor, don't get me wrong. Getting stronger in the gym will absolutely help you push harder into the ice and be more stable when someone tries to hit you.
But a 500-pound squat will absolutely not fix a biomechanically flawed skating stride.
Right. Furthermore, when you do train the lower body, the manual suggests a mix of bilateral lifts, like trap bar deadlifts, which are safer on the lower back, but you need a massive focus on single leg work.
Think Bulgarian split squats, heavy lunges, step ups.
Which makes perfect sense when you visualize it. Skating is fundamentally a single leg activity. You are never pushing with both feet at the exact same time.
No, you are shifting massive amounts of force from one leg to the other at extreme angles.
Which requires immense stability in the hips, which bilateral squats simply do not train as effectively.
Let's move to the fourth bucket, core and rotational strength. I think a lot of people think core and they just think crunches for a six pack.
Right, but in hockey, this is essential for shooting power and holding your ground. Your shot power doesn't come from your arms. It comes from the ground up, transferring through a rigid rotating trunk.
This means you need to focus on anti-rotation work. A great example is the Palloff press, where you are holding a cable or band that is trying to pull you sideways, and you have to use your core to resist that rotation and stay perfectly square.
It also heavily involves loaded carries, literally picking up heavy kettlebells or dumbbells and walking with perfect posture.
Loaded carries are unglamorous, but they are spectacular for hockey because that is exactly what a battle on the boards feels like.
Your midsection has to be a rigid cylinder that transmits force from your legs into your opponent without your spine collapsing.
And the final training bucket is mobility, specifically targeting the hips and the groin.
This is non-negotiable. If you think about the skating stride, it is a repeated, forceful hip abduction, pushing the leg violently away from the midline of the body, followed by adduction, pulling it back in to recover.
And it happens in a deeply flexed hip position, crouched over, thousands of times a game. Literally nothing else in daily human life replicates this specific movement pattern.
We're going to get into the specific terrifying injuries this causes in just a minute, but the main training takeaway here is that you need strength at the end of your range of motion.
It's not just about passive stretching. Being able to passively drop into the splits like a gymnast is totally useless for a hockey player if your muscles cannot actively produce force and stabilize the joint in that stretched position.
You need active mobility, not just flexibility.
Before we move off the training physiology, I have to offer one very honest caveat about testing all this fitness we just built.
Okay, let's hear it.
If you hang around hockey conditioning circles long enough, you will frequently hear coaches obsess over VO2 max, which is the standard laboratory measure of your maximum aerobic capacity, as the ultimate predictor of who is fit for hockey.
Wait, I'm slightly confused. If VO2 max is the gold standard for aerobic fitness, and we just spent 20 minutes talking about how crucial the aerobic alternator is for recharging the battery between shifts, why wouldn't a high VO2 max perfectly correlate with being an elite player on the ice?
It's a great paradox, and it comes down to the chaotic nature of the sport. That 2026 Gabry study we mentioned earlier, when they actually ran the numbers, they found absolutely no significant relationships between a player's laboratory VO2 max score and their actual performance during repeated high-intensity on-ice efforts.
So what does this all mean? Are the labs totally useless?
It means the mechanism of aerobic fitness aiding recovery between shifts is an absolute undeniable biological fact. Your alternator matters.
Right.
But a single steady state lab test running in a straight line on a treadmill or sitting upright on a stationary bike is a remarkably poor predictor of who actually plays well in the third period of a chaotic lateral contact heavy hockey game.
You should absolutely train the quality, build the aerobic engine, but don't obsess over chasing a specific lab score. The ice is the ultimate test.
Okay, let's pause and do a quick review of what we've learned so far.
Good idea. To master the physical demands of the game, you need the anaerobic nitrous and battery power to win a single 45-second shift, and the aerobic alternator capacity to win the third period.
And you build this through five targeted areas. An aerobic base done easily off-ice. Game-matched intense anaerobic sprint intervals.
Single leg lower body strength. Rotational core stability for transferring force. And active mobility to protect the hips.
A perfect summary. But having this incredible physical engine is only half the battle. Now, we need to transition and talk about what happens when that engine inevitably starts to fail during a long shift.
Because fatigue in hockey isn't just a physical issue. It is a profound tactical vulnerability.
Let's paint a picture of this. Imagine you get stuck out on the ice for a grueling 70-second shift. The first 15 to 20 seconds, you feel like you're flying.
Your phosphocreatine battery is fully firing. You make a hit, you sprint for a loose puck.
Gee.
But by second 30, that electric battery is dead.
Now your body is panicking, and your glycolytic nitrous system is running incredibly hot. Acidic byproducts are heavily accumulating in the muscle tissue. Your breathing is ragged.
According to a fascinating 2022 tracking study by Lugdahl, elite junior players actually spend over 11 minutes of a single game with their heart rate soaring above 90%. Their absolute maximum.
The physical cardiovascular stress is immense.
And here is the key insight, the aha moment that completely changes how you should view the game of hockey. When you hit second 60 and your lungs are burning and your legs feel like concrete, your legs actually don't fail first.
Your decision making fails first.
This is a critical coaching observation derived directly from the physiology. A tired hockey player rarely just falls over from exhaustion on the ice.
Instead, their brain, sensing the massive energy crisis in the body, starts trying to save energy by ruthlessly cutting cognitive corners.
So what does that cognitive corner cutting actually look like to someone watching from the stands?
Well, first, a tired player stops scanning the ice. Scanning, constantly turning your head to process where all nine other players are, requires immense attention.
And attention is neurologically expensive when you are gassed. So you get tunnel vision. You only stare at the puck.
Next, because of that tunnel vision, they stop making the right pass and start making the easy pass. Instead of seeing the open man across the ice, they just weakly chip it off the glass to survive the moment.
Then the physical compromises start. They stop skating hard back on defense and start gliding. And gliding through the neutral zone is exactly how you hand the other team an odd man rush.
And finally, the most obvious sign, they stop moving their feet entirely on defense and start reaching with their stick.
This is exactly where hooking, slashing, and tripping penalties come from. Your brain literally says, my legs are full of battery acid, I refuse to move them, I'll just use my arms to slow that guy down.
And you end up in the penalty box, hurting your team.
Which leads to the ultimate irony of a fatigued player. Deciding to go to the bench for a line change is, in itself, a complex tactical decision.
You have to recognize you are tired, read the play to ensure it's safe to change, and skate to the door. So a deeply fatigued player will often stay out for another 20 seconds simply because their brain is too flooded and tired to execute the executive function of choosing to change.
So if you're taking notes at home, what should we remember here? When you are gasping for air on the ice, what part of your game actually breaks down first?
It's your hockey IQ. Your brain shuts down before your legs do.
Exactly. The practical rule that emerges from understanding this biology is incredibly simple but hard to execute. Change before you need to, not when you need to.
A 40-second shift executed at high physical and cognitive quality is vastly superior to a 70-second shift, where the last 30 seconds turn you into a mental and physical liability for your team.
If you want to seem like a smarter player, be a fitter player who takes shorter shifts.
It really is that simple. But what happens when the physical strain of the game goes beyond just fatigue? What happens when the forces exceed the structural limits of the body?
We need to transition now from how the engine burns out to how the physical chassis actually breaks.
Let's get into the mechanics of physical breakdown. As we discussed earlier, the hockey stride is an incredibly unnatural human movement.
We evolved to walk and run forward, not to violently push laterally on a frictionless surface. And because it's unnatural, it breaks the body in very specific, predictable ways.
Let's start with the classic, ubiquitous hockey injury, the groin.
If you look at a 2025 study in the American Journal of Sports Medicine focusing on NHL goaltenders, proximal adductor injuries, which in layman's terms means high groin strains, accounted for the largest number of total injuries and the highest total days missed.
More than any other injury category.
And while goalies are an extreme case because of the butterfly position where they drop to their knees and flare their feet out, this pattern holds remarkably true for standard skaters too. Why?
It goes back to a landmark 2001 study by Tyler and colleagues that every hockey trainer treats as gospel. They measured preseason hip strength in professional players and found an incredible, terrifying statistic.
Let's hear it.
They found that a player was 17 times more likely to sustain an adductor groin strain during the season if their adductor strength was less than 80% of their abductor strength.
Okay, let's define those terms clearly so we can visualize what's happening to the muscles. Abduction, with a B, is pushing the leg away from the center of your body.
And adduction, with a D, is pulling the leg back into the center.
Correct. Now think about the skating stride. You powerfully train the muscles that push away the abductors. You explode outward thousands of times a game.
But there is very little physical resistance when you pull the leg back under your body to reset the stride. The skate just glides back.
Over years and years of playing, you create a massive structural muscular imbalance. The push muscles become hugely overpowered compared to the pull muscles.
If your pulling muscles, the adductors, drop below 80% of the strength of your pushing muscles, the tension differential becomes too great. One awkward reach for a puck, and the weaker adductor simply snaps. Your injury risk skyrockets by 17 times.
So the obvious, logical solution is to heavily strengthen the adductors in the gym. And for years, the hockey and sports science world treated one specific exercise like an absolute magic bullet for this. The Copenhagen adduction exercise.
But this is where the science gets wild, and I love this kind of academic drama.
Oh, yeah. It is a fascinating lesson in how sports science literature evolves and why we have to be careful.
The Copenhagen exercise is intense. It involves side lying on the ground with your top leg resting up on a bench or a partner's hip, and you have to lift your bottom leg up to meet it, holding your entire body weight with your inner thigh.
A massive 2025 systematic review in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports pooled all the data and proudly proclaimed it significantly increased adductor strength and prevented injuries.
But there is a massive but here.
The drama is that the paper was officially retracted in April 2026.
And the reason for the retraction matters deeply for how we consume fitness info. It wasn't just superseded by a slightly better news study. The journal investigated and determined the meta-analysis contained fundamental methodological flaws.
The authors had essentially misrepresented the outcomes of the smaller-sided studies to make the Copenhagen look like a miracle cure, invalidating the grand conclusions.
On top of that, the review's own authors had rated the quality of evidence underpinning their own findings as very low, yet presented it as a definitive solution.
So what's the takeaway for the listener here? If I'm a player terrified of a groin tear, do I stop training the groin? Do I abandon the exercise?
No, absolutely not. The original Tyler risk factor finding from 2001 that a muscular imbalance causes a 17x risk increase is still highly valid and is measured specifically in hockey players.
What the retraction means is that you shouldn't blindly trust that one single trendy exercise you saw on YouTube is a magical, impenetrable shield against injury.
You must strengthen the adductor area using a variety of movements. Lateral lunges, slide board work, cable pulls.
But most importantly, if you have recurring groin pain, you need to see a physiotherapist for a tailored plan. Not just stubbornly do Copenhagen planks because an influencer said it was bulletproof.
That perfectly transitions into the next major breakdown, the hips. We talk a lot about muscles, but the hip joint itself is the silent killer of hockey careers.
It truly is. This is where biology gets a bit frightening. Repeated, forceful movement in deep hip flexion, which is the fundamental hockey crouch, doesn't just strain muscles. It physically reshapes the bones in a hockey player's hips over time.
A 2024 study by Abramson looked at former elite Swedish hockey players who are seeking orthopedic help for chronic hip and groin pain. They found that an astounding 81% of these symptomatic players had what is clinically called CAM morphology.
CAM morphology meaning what exactly? Extra bone growth.
Yes. The body responds to the extreme repetitive mechanical stress of the femur grinding against the hip socket during the stride by laying down extra bone on the neck of the femur.
The bone literally thickens to protect itself, turning a smooth ball joint into an irregular cam-shaped joint that grinds and pinches the cartilage.
We also see this biological adaptation starting frighteningly early. A 2026 study of youth ice hockey athletes found clinical signs of femoroacetabular impingement syndrome in over 60% of the kids they imaged.
But I want to provide some crucial context here. So parents listening, don't immediately panic and pull their kids out of hockey. That 81% number in the Swedish study was from players who were already going to a specialized clinic because they were in severe pain.
It's not saying 81% of all hockey players everywhere need hip surgery. Selection bias is at play there.
CAM morphology is actually extremely common in many athletic populations, and many players have the extra bone growth with absolutely zero pain or symptoms.
The critical takeaway for the listener is this. Hip and groin pain in hockey players is incredibly common. It is often a structural bone issue, and it is not just a tight muscle that needs to be stretched out.
In fact, if you have persistent deep hip pinching, aggressive static stretching can actually jam the bone further into the cartilage and make it much worse. If you have chronic hip pain on a wide stride, go see a sports physician and get an image.
Let's move from the lower body to the upper body. When people think of traumatic hockey injuries from collisions, they usually think of shoulders separating from hitting the boards or wrists snapping from getting slashed.
And the epidemiological data largely supports that intuition. A massive data set analyzing over 250,000 youth hockey injuries found that about 36% of all injuries involved the upper extremity.
Of those, the shoulder region was far and away the most common site of injury.
Now, wait a minute. I need to clear something up. I read a very popular article online a few months ago that stated 27% of all fractures in ice hockey are in the hand. That sounds terrifying for anyone who needs to type for a living.
This is exactly why we have to read the primary medical literature carefully and why internet aggregation is dangerous. That statistic is widely misquoted across hundreds of blogs.
A definitive 2026 fracture study by Ried and colleagues looked at this explicitly and found that the most common fracture sites were the shoulder at 27.0%, the wrist at 19.3%, and the lower arm at 11.3%.
So that 27% fracture rate belongs to the collarbones and shoulders, not the tiny bones in the hand. The internet just swapped the words. We rely on primary facts here, folks.
The wrist is undeniably highly vulnerable, often from vicious slashes that land in the unprotected gap between the glove and the elbow pad, or from bracing a fall on the ice. But the shoulder complex takes the brunt of the heavy structural damage in hockey.
To quickly summarize this physical breakdown section, the unnatural lateral stride creates a dangerous muscular imbalance in your groin that increases injury risk 17-fold.
The deep flexion crouch can literally alter the shape of your hip bones over time, and high-speed collisions heavily threaten your shoulders and wrists.
However, we can surgically repair or physically rehab all of these orthopedic injuries. You can get a new hip, but we have to transition now to an injury we cannot simply rehab.
We can replace a hip. We absolutely cannot replace a human brain. Let's transition from orthopedic trauma to neurological trauma. And we are going to treat this topic with the absolute lack of nuance it deserves.
There is no gray area here.
None at all.
The current international medical reference is the consensus statement from the 6th International Conference on Concussion in Sport, which was published in 2023 in Amsterdam.
And the absolute ironclad rule for all levels of play is this. If a concussion is suspected, the player comes off the ice and does not return to play that day. Period. No exceptions.
Not for the next shift, not for the third period, not for the championship game.
I want to highlight the word suspected. You do not need a medical degree on the bench to sit someone down. You don't need a definitive diagnosis. If in doubt, sit them out.
And we have to kill the biggest, most dangerous myth in amateur contact sports right now. You do not have to be knocked out to have a severe concussion.
Loss of consciousness is not required, and biologically, it is not even typical. Waiting to see if someone is knocked out cold before taking a head hit seriously is incredibly dangerous. A brain can sustain massive shearing forces without shutting down consciousness.
To help with this, the Amsterdam Consensus provided a brilliant tool specifically designed for non-medical people on the bench. Coaches, parents, teammates. It's called the Concussion Recognition Tool 6, or CRT6.
It lists 10 critical red flags. Yeah. If you see any one of these red flags after a collision, you do not wait to see how they feel in 5 minutes. You call an ambulance immediately. Let's walk through them.
The 10 emergency red flags are neck pain or tenderness, which hints at a spinal issue, a seizure or convulsion, loss of vision or double vision, any loss of consciousness.
Increased confusion or a deteriorating conscious state, meaning they are getting progressively drowsy or groggy. Weakness, tingling or burning in more than one arm or leg. Repeated vomiting.
A severe or increasing headache, becoming increasingly restless, agitated, or wildly combative. And finally, any visible deformity of the skull.
I really want to emphasize the nuance between an ordinary concussion symptom and an emergency red flag. If a player takes a hit and has a mild headache, that's a symptom. If they have a headache that is progressively getting worse by the minute, that is a red flag.
Right. If they are slightly confused about the score of the game, that's a symptom. If their confusion is escalating and they don't know where they are, that's a red flag.
Why is that specific distinction so critical for the listener to understand?
Because a symptom that is rapidly worsening, like an escalating headache or deteriorating consciousness, is the classic neurological presentation of an evolving bleed inside the skull, such as an epidural hematoma.
As the blood pools, it increases intracranial pressure, pushing on the brain. That is a life-threatening, time-sensitive emergency requiring neurosurgery, not just a standard concussion. You don't put ice on that, you call 911.
What are the immediate first aid rules if a player goes down hard and stays down?
The CRT6 protocol is very clear. First, assume a possible spinal cord injury in all cases of significant head trauma. Second, do not attempt to move the athlete unless you are medically trained to do so. Don't drag them to the bench.
Third, do not remove their helmet. Removing a helmet can manipulate the cervical spine. Wait for the trained paramedics.
Let's look at the more common scenario. A player takes a hit. They're woozy, but there are no ambulance-level red flags. They get off the ice. What happens next? The first 3 hours post-injury are crucial.
They cannot be left alone for at least the first 3 hours. Someone must monitor them for those worsening red flags. They cannot be sent home by themselves. They must not drive a motor vehicle. And crucially, they must not consume alcohol or recreational drugs.
I know this completely ruins the classic time-honored rec league tradition of having a post-game beer in the parking lot of the locker room. But alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. It masks worsening neurological symptoms.
You won't know if they're slurring their words because of a brain bleed or because of the beer. It is vital you avoid it.
If you only remember one single thing from this entire discussion on the brain, I want you to answer this question. Who makes the ultimate call on when a player is safe to return to the ice?
Think about it. It is absolutely, unequivocally never the player.
Exactly. Return to play is exclusively a medical decision. The nature of a brain injury inherently impairs the player's cognitive judgment and self-awareness. They will passionately tell you they are fine. They will beg to go back in.
They are not biologically qualified to make that call, and neither is the coach whose job might depend on winning. A qualified medical professional must clear them through a structured, multi-day, graded return protocol.
We just discussed the terrifying reality of concussions, which naturally brings up the question,
okay,
what is the single best way to prevent them? It's not doing neck strengthening exercises in the gym. It's not buying a $400 helmet, though that helps against skull fractures. The ultimate prevention tool is in the rule book.
This is a harsh reality where physical conditioning cannot save you from the laws of physics. The 2025 Youth Narrative Review reports that body checking is the single most significant modifiable risk factor in the sport of ice hockey.
Allowing body checking in a league is associated with a threefold increase in concussion incidents.
A 300% increase just by changing one rule.
And the reverse is equally true. Policy interventions that prohibit body checking produce massive 50% to 70% reductions in overall injury rates across the board.
This means knowing the exact rule book of your specific league dictates your actual statistical physical risk. For example, USA Hockey explicitly bans body checking in all non-Czech adult rec leagues and all women's classifications.
And if you look internationally, the IIHF rules, which govern play in places like Britain and the Olympics, are slightly different in their nuance.
They allow body checking in women's hockey only if there is a clear, overt intention of playing the puck. But they strictly and severely penalize using the boards to eliminate an opponent or gliding into a stationary player.
The major point here is that your physical preparation changes depending on the rules you play under. The rule book is your primary armor. If you play in a checking league, your neck, shoulder, and core prep must be flawless.
Having covered the extreme traumatic injuries, the torn groins, the concussions, let's look at the mundane, everyday habits that actually dictate whether you get a soft tissue injury or simply run out of gas in the second period. Let's talk about the unsung heroes of performance, warm-ups, and fueling.
I'll be honest, everyone hates warming up. We all just want to step onto the fresh ice, feel the glide, and start ripping pucks at the goalie. But the scientific data on structured warm-ups is completely undeniable.
It is. If we look outside hockey for a moment at the FIFA 11 Plus data, which is a heavily studied standardized soccer warm-up protocol, a massive 2025 meta-analysis by Liu found that implementing structured warm-up programs reduces total injuries by 35%.
But the most important finding of that study wasn't the specific exercises in the program. It was the human behavior element. Compliance.
Precisely. In hamstring injury research, high adherence to a warm-up routine was associated with a staggering 66% lower risk of injury. Low adherence, meaning you only do it when you feel like it, showed essentially zero protective benefit.
A highly mediocre warm-up routine that you execute every single time you play is vastly superior to a scientifically perfect hour-long routine that you only muster the energy to do twice a season.
In the biology of injury prevention, consistency beats perfection every time.
So what should a hockey player actually do before a game? The manual heavily suggests the ramp framework. It takes 10 to 15 minutes off the ice in your street clothes before you even put your gear on. RAMP.
Raise, mobilize, activate, potentiate. Let's break that down. First, raise your core body temperature and heart rate with a light jog or skipping. Get a light sweat going.
Second, M, mobilize your joints through their full range of motion. Leg swings, walking lunges, opening up the hips.
Third, A. Activate the specific muscle groups you'll use on the ice, like doing glute bridges or lateral band walks to fire up those abductors.
Finally, P. Potentiate your central nervous system with a few short, highly explosive movements, like near maximal vertical jumps or 5-yard sprints. You are telling your brain it's time to be fast.
Notice what is explicitly missing from that ramp protocol. Static stretching. You know, bending over and touching your toes for 30 seconds. You should actively skip static stretching right before games.
A 2025 review found it can actually transiently reduce your maximal isometric strength. You want your muscles to act like tightly coiled, springy rubber bands. Static stretching turns them into loose, relaxed shoelaces. Save the stretching for after the game.
Now let's talk about fueling. We established earlier that the intense intervals of hockey cause severe glycogen depletion in the muscles. To combat this, standard sports nutrition practice dictates eating a significant carbohydrate-focused meal 3 to 4 hours before the puck drops.
And hydration is massively underestimated in hockey, primarily because ice rinks are physically cold, so players don't realize how much they are sweating under all that heavy insulated gear.
The Elite Hockey Nutrition Review reports average sweat losses of around 2 liters per hour of play. A fascinating 2025 study of NCAA hockey players found that even the morning after a game, players still walked around with a 1.2% body water deficit.
You are losing a massive amount of fluid out there, and chronic dehydration destroys both aerobic capacity and cognitive decision making.
Which brings us to a hyper-specific, incredibly relatable issue for the amateur player, the late-night rec game problem. I lament this reality constantly.
The ice time is cheap, so the puck drops at 10:30 p.m. on a Tuesday. You haven't eaten a real meal since 6:00 p.m. You're exhausted from a full day of work. And when the game finishes at midnight, you are highly adrenalized, deeply dehydrated, and absolutely starving. How on earth do you handle this biologically without ruining your next day?
It's the toughest scenario in amateur sports. The manual provides a very pragmatic, realistic solution. First, eat a real carb-heavy meal at 6:30 p.m. Then have a small, easily digestible top-up snack like a banana or a sports drink an hour before the game.
But the absolute key to the post-game is behavior. You must rehydrate and eat a recovery snack at the rink while you are taking off your gear in the locker room. Do not wait until 1:00 a.m. when you finally get home and end up eating a frozen pizza.
And psychologically, you just have to accept the sleep loss. Don't lie in bed staring at the ceiling, stressing about the fact that you are too wired to sleep. Accept it. Plan your Wednesday morning around the biological fact that you will be tired, and don't schedule your hardest work meeting for 8:00 a.m.
Which leads us perfectly into the broader science of recovery. Let's take a hard look at the billion-dollar athletic recovery industry and audit it against actual science. Everyone wants a $300 massage gun, a fancy compression boot system, or a magic supplement powder.
But the strongest, highest leverage recovery tool in existence is completely free, and most people ignore it.
It's sleep. It's always sleep.
It is sleep. A recent preprint study tracked athletes and found that short sleep duration is significantly associated with a higher injury risk, an odds ratio of 1.34, which translates to roughly a 34% increase in your likelihood of getting hurt simply because you didn't sleep enough.
The nervous system is too fatigued to protect the joints. Preemptive napping of 20 to 30 minutes on game day is a highly legitimate, scientifically backed tool to combat this deficit.
Nutrition is the next strongest recovery tool. And amateurs get this wrong all the time. After a hard game, everyone chugs a massive protein shake because they want to rebuild muscle. But what does the biochemistry actually demand?
Carbohydrates are the absolute priority. You have to resynthesize that depleted muscle glycogen we talked about earlier so you have fuel for tomorrow. A revealing 2025 survey showed that amateur athletes vastly overestimate their protein needs post-game and drastically underestimate the massive amount of carbs required to actually refill the tank.
Have some protein, yes, but pair it with a mountain of rice or pasta.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Ice baths. Cold water immersion. If you watch any behind-the-scenes NHL documentary, you see players sitting in tubs of ice constantly. Is it actually good for you?
It is a profound biological paradox. Multiple literature reviews confirm that cold water immersion reliably reduces perceived muscle soreness. It acts as an analgesic. You will genuinely feel better and less stiff walking out of the arena.
However, a major 2026 network meta-analysis and a highly detailed 2025 mechanistic study by Betts reveal a massive counterintuitive catch.
The catch being that extreme cold physically blunts microvascular perfusion, blood flow to the tiny capillaries, and it significantly blunts amino acid incorporation into the muscle tissue.
Let me translate that into practical terms for our listener. Why should you absolutely avoid getting into an ice bath after a heavy, successful Tuesday night squat session in the gym?
Because the ice bath literally kills your gains. The cold water stops the body's natural inflammatory adaptation response. When you lift weights, you create micro tears and inflammation. The body senses this, sends blood and protein to the area, and builds the muscle back stronger. That inflammation is the exact signal that builds strength. If you jump in an ice bath, you silence the signal.
So if you are playing in a grueling weekend tournament, and you have a game Saturday night and another one Sunday morning, and you just need to numb the pain and feel good enough to play again, yes, take the ice bath. But if you take an ice bath after a gym session, where your primary goal is to adapt and get stronger, absolutely not. You are actively ruining the workout you just did.
What about other popular tools, like expensive compression garments and foam rolling?
The scientific literature on compression garments is highly contested and ultimately inconclusive regarding actual physiological recovery. Foam rolling is similar to ice. It definitely helps with perceived soreness and provides a very temporary increase in range of motion, but there is very weak evidence that it actually prevents injury or improves long-term tissue quality.
So save your money. Sleep 8 hours, eat a bowl of pasta, and drink a liter of water. Now, how do we apply all of this intense biology, tactical knowledge, and recovery science across a whole lifespan? Whether you are a busy 40-year-old adult just trying to stay in the game, or you are a parent raising a 10-year-old youth player, let's talk about the lifelong player.
Let's start with the adult recreational player. The golden rule of adult physiology is that consistency beats intensity. If you are a parent with a demanding job and you only have 90 total minutes a week to train outside of your ice times, the manual gives a very precise, optimized breakdown of how to spend those minutes.
Session one is 45 minutes of dedicated strength work. You do a squat or a hinge movement. You do your single leg work for stability. You hit your core with anti-rotation exercises. And you religiously hit that groin with adductor work to stave off the 17x injury risk.
Session two, later in the week, is 30 minutes of conditioning. Either those brutal 40-second sprint intervals on a bike or the easy conversational aerobic work to build the alternator, depending on what you lack. And finally, you sprinkle 15 minutes of active hip mobility across the week while watching TV in the evening.
And you must periodize this over the calendar year. The off-season, the summer, is when you push hard and build the engine. The in-season is strictly when you maintain. Once the season starts, your actual hockey games are your hard conditioning.
You only need one, maybe two short gym sessions a week just to maintain your structural strength. If you try to train in January with the same volume you did in July, your nervous system will crash and you will burn out or get injured.
And what about youth players? Because the pressure in youth hockey right now to treat 10-year-old kids like elite, miniature adult professionals is completely out of control.
The pediatric medical consensus is entirely unified here. Do not treat kids as mini adults. Their biology is fundamentally different. Their skeletal growth plates are open and highly vulnerable to sheer forces that an adult skeleton can easily shrug off.
The manual heavily highlights the specific risks of early sports specialization, playing nothing but hockey 12 months a year from age 8.
The physiological and psychological guidelines are incredibly clear. Do not specialize a child in a single sport before age 12. They need to play soccer, baseball, gymnastics, build a broad athletic chassis before narrowing in on hockey.
Furthermore, the number of organized training hours per week should never exceed the child's age and years. An 11-year-old should absolutely not be doing more than 11 hours of organized coach sports a week. The burnout and overuse injury rates skyrocket past that threshold.
We also hear a lot of fear from parents around kids lifting weights. The old myth is that lifting weights will stunt a kid's growth. Is that true?
The National Strength and Conditioning Association consensus statement is very clear on this. Youth resistance training is not only safe, it is highly beneficial for strengthening bones and preventing injury, but with one massive non-negotiable condition.
It must be strictly supervised by a qualified, educated coach. The danger to youth isn't the physical iron weights themselves. The danger is a lack of supervision, terrible form, and inappropriate ego loading by kids trying to show off.
Get a qualified coach. Don't just drop them off at the local commercial gym.
Okay.
We have covered an immense, staggering amount of ground today. We have deconstructed the chaotic game of hockey from the cellular biochemistry of an ATP molecule all the way up to the physical rulebook of international play.
Yeah, the most important part of learning. Let's build the final integrated mental model. Let's synthesize all of this into a framework that you can easily remember and use tomorrow.
I like to think of your hockey body as a complex, highly specialized machine. The aerobic system is your alternator, your battery charger, constantly working in the background. The anaerobic system is your powerful nitrous-injected motor that wins the five-second battles.
Your adductor muscles and your hips are the transmission of the machine. They are absolutely vital for transferring power from the motor to the ice, but they are incredibly prone to snapping if they become structurally unbalanced.
And your brain is the onboard computer. It fails tactically when the physical chassis runs low on fuel, leading to terrible decisions and penalties. And if it is physically struck by an opposing player, it requires an immediate, non-negotiable emergency shutdown and reboot.
If you are going to forget everything else we talked about, if you only remember 10 foundational truths from this entire masterclass, remember these. Number one, hockey is intensely anaerobic inside the shift, but it is deeply aerobic across the span of a whole game.
Number two, change your shift at 45 seconds to protect your cognitive decision-making, not just because your legs are tired.
Number three, your pulling adductors are naturally weaker than your pushing abductors. You must actively train them to fix that terrifying 17 times injury risk.
Number four, a mediocre 10-minute warm-up done consistently before every game beats a perfect warm-up done rarely.
Number five, don't chase a VO2 max lab score on a treadmill. Chase your actual ability to recover your heart rate between shifts on the bench.
Number six, any worsening symptom after a head knock, like an escalating headache, means you call an ambulance immediately because it might be a bleed.
Number seven, there is absolutely no same-day return to play for any suspected concussion, ever.
Number eight, Body checking rules dictate your actual statistical physical risk, increasing concussions by 300%. Know your league's rules.
Number 9. Ice baths literally kill muscle adaptation and strength gains after a gym session, even if they make you feel nice and numb.
And number 10. Sleep is the highest leverage, cheapest, most effective recovery tool in human existence.
What an incredible list. I want to sincerely thank you, the listener, for taking this incredibly deep dive into the science of hockey conditioning with us today. You now have the underlying knowledge to outlast, outsmart, and outprepare your opponents.
You now understand the profound why behind the sweat. You aren't just blindly doing drills anymore. You are actively engineering your own physiology.
Exactly. I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as you pack your gear bag for your next skate. We routinely see players gladly spend thousands of dollars on ultralight carbon fiber sticks, custom molded skates, and profiled steel, all in a desperate attempt to gain maybe a tiny 1% edge on the ice.
But considering what we just learned about muscle glycogen depletion, the reality of hip bone morphology, and the absolute undeniable power of sleep, is it possible that the greatest competitive advantage you can buy for your game next week is simply a $10 bag of pasta at 6:30 p.m. and having the discipline to go to bed an hour earlier?
Think about it. We'll see you next time.